Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztraber. On today's show, video games, the workforce, STEM education. What do these things have to do with each other? Recently, we had Mike Gallagher from the Entertainment Software Association on this show to talk about all the various ways in which technology policy impacts the video game industry and why gamers should care about what their government is up to. Today, we're going to go a little bit deeper and focus on a few of these issues more in depth with someone else from ESA. So Eric Huey is the Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Entertainment Software Association. And to remind listeners, that is the trade group that represents the video game industry. So Eric, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you, Evan, and thanks to Tech Freedom.
So this might not be intuitive to folks, but the video game industry is important for jobs. It's important for the American workforce. Can you give folks a sense of just what type of size we're looking at here? I mean, is this a big job creator, much smaller?
It's a huge job creator, and it's only growing. This industry is a $30 billion domestic industry and $110 billion worldwide. So it's growing. It's now larger than box office Hollywood and the music industry combined. So interactive technology is the wave of the future. It's the way that people interact with not just with computers, but with content. And you see that in the way that movies are made. You see that in the way that sports are covered. You know, they adopt a lot of the you know, Madden angle approaches and FIFA and those things. And these innovations that happen in our industry are then bleeding over into other tech and entertainment industries. And in the process, we're creating a tremendous amount of jobs and job pathways. When you think about what it takes to fuel a $30 billion domestic industry, people probably tend to think of our industry, if they think about it, in terms of Silicon Valley or Seattle or maybe Austin and Los Angeles, maybe Boston. But the reality is there are 2,700 different video game companies in the U.S. in 3,080 different locations. So we have video game locations across over 90% of congressional districts. These are actual video games companies that are up and running. And there are a number of reasons for this. There are very low barriers to entry right now. You can create a video game and put it into the Apple Store. You could put it up on Steam. You could put it into a whole range of different streams of commerce and have the consumers vote with their pocketbooks or vote with their feet and go there. So you have low barriers to entry. The skills that are required, oftentimes you have the availability of game design engines like Unity, like Unreal Engine, even you know, things like Scratch and smaller games, and you can create a compelling content. So as long as you have coding skills and you have some basic graphic skills or know somebody and you combine together in a team and you have broadband access, you can create a video game. And we're seeing that in this explosion of the ecosystem beyond the traditional hubs to across the entire nation. We now employ about 220,000 people directly and indirectly across the United States. And these jobs are at the epicenter of the creative tech economy. The average salary is $100,000 in our industry. So these are sought after jobs. And they're not just engineering jobs. I mean, there are certainly a lot of coding jobs. But for every coding job, our member companies tell us there are 1.5 to 2 different graphics jobs, and then those enable a whole lot of other jobs. So you have these whole teams working together, so it's a real right brain, left brain industry, and that creates a lot of different pathways, which is why you see universities from Parsons School of Design and RISD and SCAD down in Savannah offering video game design programs, and you also see traditional engineering schools like Carnegie Mellon and MIT and elsewhere offering video game design schools. And within a particular university, you see the programs like at Carnegie Mellon, it's the drama program and the engineering program that got together and formed their program. So
we're seeing some strange bedfellows. Now, getting to that skills issue, though, so we hear this from the tech industry all the time about STEM, right? We're talking about science, technology, engineering, and math. And while you have managed to find 220,000 people with the right skills so far, we hear the refrain often that there is a gap in the United States workforce with skills, and that's one of the reasons why immigration is important to the tech industry. To what extent does your industry worry about essentially not enough Americans
taking up STEM as their major in college or not enough people getting those coding skills. And as you grow and you keep going from 30 billion and you're growing more and more and more, is there going to be a point where you run out of people to hire?
Yeah, I mean, some would say that we're at that point. And we think about STEM a lot, and we actually expand it to STEAM. So it's science, technology, engineering, arts, and
Not to be confused with the game platform STEAM.
There's probably, there's certainly a connection, but that's exactly right. There's STEAM skills, and then there's the game platform. You can use your STEAM skills to develop games for the STEAM platform.
Nice.
Preparing workers for the future workforce is job number one for our companies. You look at a company like Microsoft, and they've reported as many as 3,000 to 5,000 STEM jobs that are currently open that they can't fill. We talked to some of our smaller member companies like Epic Games in North Carolina. A lot of times they'll have jobs sit open for months on end, and they need, you know, the cycling time on these games is quick. They need people now. So there is a skills gap. It's being closed by these colleges and universities. So we view it as two sides of the same coin. We feel that there is a need to recalibrate the educational system in terms of its outputs to match more closely the inputs that are needed by the 21st century digital economy.
So when we think about the role of government versus the role of industry, right? Like, you can look at the education system and say, we failed in many ways to make it more vocational when it comes to coding, or people are still too focused on the liberal arts degree and they're not measuring the return on investment of these very expensive, often hundreds of thousands of dollars that people spend just for undergraduate, let alone graduate. That's potentially a government problem when we talk about public universities. But to the extent that you can't just expect the education system to change overnight, can industry make direct investments in education? Is there essentially a need for you to train people directly? Or are we looking at more of an advocacy thing where the industry goes to government and says, these are the policies that would help us? Or is it some combination? I mean, are you spending actual dollars to give people skills? Or is it more about getting the government to improve education?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. As one of our CEOs recently said at a White House meeting, I need less philosophy majors from Harvard, and I need more graduates from community colleges who can do C++ coding, who know the Unity engine. And that presents a tremendous amount of opportunities from a policy perspective, because it signals to people who might feel that a four-year traditional liberal arts education is out of their reach, either financially, geographically, or for other socioeconomic reasons. It signals to them that this is a career path that you can do. And these are not just people who are on the verge of going to college. These are people who are retraining. These are 20th century industrial workers who are retraining to the 21st century workforce and thinking, can I go to the local vocational technical center? Can I go to the local community college and get the skills that I need and then have a job waiting for me on the front end? But then you think down into STEM, and you think of particularly, you know, girls who drop out of STEM and a lot of boys as well. It starts in the eighth grade. You go into an eighth grade class, and I have, and say, who wants to be a video game designer when you grow up? Every hand goes up. They yeah. just say, that's a thing.
I would keep my hand down and say, no, I'm good to just keep playing them.
it's a combination of things. I mean, we certainly as an industry look to mentorship. We look to internship programs. We have a new partnership with the colleges and universities that offer video game design. There are now over 520 games that have colleges and universities that have game programs, game design programs. So more than a course, this could be a major, this could be a concentration, this could be an advanced degree, undergraduate or graduate. And we formed one of the things we've done is formed a consortium of these universities called the Higher Education Video Game Alliance. And this is an alliance of all the schools that teach this. Because I was talking to somebody from Carnegie Mellon, and they said, could you put me in touch with the head of the USC program? And I said, you guys don't know each other? And you realize that there's not a conversation going on. And what we're trying to do is interject into sort of their academic offerings and syllabi a practical reality of here's what the industry needs. So we're trying to find opportunities for adjunct professorships for people in our industry. We're trying to find internship possibilities for their graduates and their summer students who come in. Electronic Arts, for instance, had a partnership with Carnegie Mellon where they were taking a few dozen students every year, and then presto, those kids had jobs when they graduated.
So those are great examples of how the industry can get more hands-on with the education system. Now, when it comes to how policymakers are looking at the future of video games, I think there's broad consensus that we're going to see more virtual, mixed, and augmented realities.
That's right.
Most people who are not necessarily following this religiously might only have encountered this with Pokemon Go, which was like one of the first big attempts at augmented reality that really got into the national conversation. A lot of the reasons that was in the national conversation were really funny because people would just walk into the street not looking, or maybe not too funny, depending on what happens. You had Uber drivers saying, no, I will not pull over on the highway so you can catch a Pokemon. That's insane. But, you know, maybe since then it's kind of gone out of the public eye. But there are certainly members of Congress who are interested in this. This year we saw the launch of the Reality Caucus. I mean, yes. We have caucuses for freaking everything in Congress. You got the baseball caucus and the whatever caucus. But this one seems actually serious. But is this actually a positive development? Because, you know, one of the cliches we have about government is that it doesn't keep up well with technology. It doesn't necessarily understand it all that well. And that the knee-jerk reactions or the haphazard ways it tries to regulate or get out in front of things often backfire. So should Americans be excited that their representatives are looking at virtual, augmented, and mixed reality? Or should they be like, maybe you should leave that alone? I mean, do you see it as a positive development, the Reality Caucus?
We very much see it as a positive development. The fact that policymakers are interested in this space and interested in a good way and interested in the possibility that and the potential for this medium and this interactive technology to not just communicate, but to educate and what that means going forward. I look at the education component of video games in two forms. I think in form number one is utilizing this platform as a really particularly, it's not just pervasive, it's extraordinarily effective in teaching skills. In other words, you know, if you are playing Rocket League and you're not leveling up, if you're not doing well in a particular tournament or a particular competition, you come back at it.
Believe me, I do.
failure begets, you know, more trying and yeah. more time on task and more grit and more persistence. Whereas in the real world educational content sphere, oftentimes failure begets throwing down your pencil in frustration and hitting stop. Failure
is a brick wall. 50% of college students don't end up graduating or something like that.
Yeah. That's what we find that this platform can be extraordinarily effective as a as an assessment tool. And Gates and MacArthur Foundation and Ford Foundation and Kaiser Family Foundation are all looking at that. The Sesame Street Foundation, Joan Gans Cooney, are all looking at this as a way, because this is how kids are learning in outside of school in interactive environments, in an interactive way. So you have to meet them where they are, and how do we sort of gamify education? So that's one component of it. The other component of it is actually learning by virtue of designing games themselves. If you have to create a video game based on Romeo and Juliet as part of your 10th grade English class or some combo class, you've got to actually learn and master the content in order to create the game mechanics thereon. So they're sort of flip sides of the same coin. In terms of the interest by folks in the Reality Caucus, and there's also an eTech Caucus, which has 125 members, and these are people who are very interested in video games as a growing technology, and they want to nurture the technology. When you look at where they're going, they see that things like virtual reality have the possibility to totally revolutionize the way that human beings not just interact with technology, but the way human beings learn. So you can imagine a situation, for instance, where you're learning about Michelangelo. And rather than seeing a slide presentation in a class of the Sistine Chapel, you actually are there. You're in the Sistine Chapel, and you're in the perspective of Michelangelo, and you're there as God is touching Adam's finger, and you have a much different appreciation for that. Think about the Battle of Gettysburg and seeing it at 360 degrees and understanding. So especially for children who don't live in major metropolitan areas, who I'm from West Virginia, and I've talked to Senator Manchin and about what we can do in McDowell County in southern West Virginia. Impoverished county. If you're a kid in McDowell County, virtual reality is a portal into places that you may never get to travel. And it's also a way to show you that you can get there.
Right. So, yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned all of these ways that video games could actually complement or directly educate people, because it's often not what we hear from policymakers. You can score a lot of cheap, easy points by blaming video games for violence in the culture. Or you could say that these damn kids are staring at their phones or they're on the video games. They should be out playing in the streets like I did as a kid, right? So there's all that scapegoating going on. Yet at the same time, we're now seeing the professionalization of video games, esports. And for folks that are not aware, you can, in many places now, get a college scholarship for being really good at a video game. Now, how should the average person like grasp this, right? So you might just be thinking, wow, we've really hit a new low, right? that like not only are kids wasting an enormous amount of time playing video games, they'll say that it's a waste, but now they're getting rewarded for doing such things. I mean, and now you've got people watching people playing video games. Like, yeah, that's a relative, you know, we've seen that over the past years where Twitch and these platforms where you can now see championships and see the best people in the world play StarCraft against each other. Is this a good thing for our education system? I mean, sell a skeptic, right? You look at this and you're going to say, wow, I really don't want public money going to this kind of crap. Like, I think this is a waste of time. I mean, is esports a positive development, you know, for education? And even if it's not for education, is it a positive development for the economy?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of time, anytime there's a technological revolution, people spend a lot of time saying, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? Well, it's a thing. And esports is a thing. Twitch is a thing. When you look at the valuation and what it was purchased for, $2 to $3 billion. And then you look at the time spent on Twitch. The average Twitch viewer is on for 51 minutes. 51 minutes is an extraordinarily long period of time.
That's an episode of a TV show. Yeah, basically. Absolutely.
Or maybe two episodes.
Yeah.
And when you look at the numbers, the League of Legends final on Twitch had more viewers than the series finales, not the season finale, the series finales of The Sopranos, 24, and Breaking Bad combined.
I've watched all three of those.
Yeah, as have I, and they're all terrific. But this is a new form of content. It's attracting a new and younger audience. But esports competition, there's something innate in the human genome that makes us want to watch the person who is best at something.
Right, that's why we watch sports. Yeah,
exactly. And esports is really no different. You want to watch Michael Jordan dunk a basketball because he's the best in the world at it. You want to watch Cloud9, you know, play in a League of Legends tournament because they're the best at it. If that's what you, if you like League of Legends and you want to learn, you want to get tips, you want to go on YouTube and watch videos of how to play better. But these tournaments, the amount of people they're attracting in person and online are really revolutionizing sports viewership, and that's why you're seeing colleges offering scholarships and competing. So I was just out at University California, Irvine, and they've got a whole new esports center. Washington, D.C. is building a new arena that the Mystics are going to use, but it's also going to be an esports arena, and you're going to have a Washington, D.C. sports team. The NFL just announced a new Madden partnership with Electronic Arts where they're going to have these massive tournaments, and you're going to get the best players representing every team, and then the teams are going to compete against one another. The NBA did something similar with Take-Two. So this is a wave of the future, and it is a thing, and it's only going to be a growing thing.
And in order to get the most value out of the changes that we're seeing in the video game industry for the most people, what would be your message to policymakers? Are there bills sitting around that you would pass in a heartbeat if you had the power? Are there things that government can do to facilitate this industry to make sure that what's going on helps everyone or just, you know, creates benefit for society? Just essentially, what would be your final words, assuming that there's someone listening to this show out there that has a say in what our policy on video games is?
Coding skills are going to be the lingua franca of the 21st century tech economy. In much the same way, in the old days, people used to say, I'm proficient in WordPerfect on their resume.
I still have that, yeah.
or I'm proficient in Word. Now you have to know Word and PowerPoint as part of just a functioning, you know, student.
Yeah, that's not like a difference maker anymore.
Yeah, it's not a competitive differentiator. Unity or Unreal, the skills in those types of video game design engines, whether or not you're programming video games or not, you could be an architect, you could be a real estate developer, you could be, if you want to convey information, if you want to present information in an engaging, compelling way, you're going to have to do it in a 360 degrees interactive way. Knowing these engines and knowing having basic coding skills is going to be critical to that. And as we think about our 21st century forward-looking educational policy, long-term, we have to think about how we're going to embed this into schools, starting in middle school and going forward, so that every kid is learning to code to a degree, and this will enable a pathway for the kids that are really good at it to continue, go to college and go out into the tech space, because that's where the jobs are. So you've got to incubate that, and you've got to nurture that at an early age. So ed policy really ought to be looking at ways. This could be the Perkins Act reauthorization. There could be specific things that are happening on No Child Left Behind as they sort of revisit what the next version of that might look like. How are we going to create more tech savvy and tech ambidextrous tech skills within our student base?
And if you want to know what's going on in your state, go to areweinyourstate.org. This details the span of the video game industry across the country, and you can see not only the impact that the industry is having, but the programs that are available to learn design. So if you want to get a head start on Eric's recommendation that you learn that code, start now. You can go to that website. That's areweinyourstate.org. But that's it for today. My guest has been Eric Huey, Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Entertainment Software Association. Eric, thanks so much for an interesting discussion.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media at techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store, where you can please leave us a review, because we'll help others find the show. And if you want to play against me in Rocket League, send me your gamer tag at media at techfreedom.org. I do play PlayStation 4. Sorry for you Xbox people. But that's it for today. See you next time.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.